All right. So let's talk about the average person. And again, you know, one of the gripes that I have with, you know, if you're out on the internet or on the podcast sphere and you have all these researchers talking about their research, a lot of times it's focused on the work they're doing, say at the elite level, whether that's with cardio training or whether it's strength training. And sometimes I think it's very difficult for the average person to take what's appropriate at the elite level and then translate that down to something that's applicable to them in their life, given the fact that they're not athletes or they're not training for competition. So I'd like to have a conversation about how do we look at interval training, high intensity interval training? And I think we need to define what intensity is, because I think people, the analogy I always think about, I'm a CrossFit fan. And so years ago, I was writing some blog articles. I was saying, if you think about, you know, someone says do high intensity work and your concept of that is the output level of the CrossFit Games champion, like, you know, the four-time champions, five-time champions, Matt Fraser, you're making the wrong comparison, because intensity is relative to your own capacity where you are right now. And so I'd like to get your thoughts on that. But if we can start talking about, oh gosh, my brain is everywhere right now. I love it. At least in my own thought process, if someone said to me high intensity interval training, the name Tabata comes to mind. And I think maybe other people have the same thing. So they think, well, if I'm going to do high intensity intervals, it's got to be 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off, repeated 8 times. I can't do that. But I've heard you say in other podcasts, particularly one comes to mind, the one you did with Tim Ferriss, is that you get to define your intervals and your rest periods. It's, I think in your words, infinitely variable, which is so important for us clinically, because I can't tell a lot of my clients to go push as hard as you can for 20 seconds. And you, by the way, you get 10 seconds of rest. And so we can talk about work rest intervals and the ratios, whether it's 2-1, 1-1, 1-2, 1-4, and whether or not the work intervals are 20 seconds or 2 minutes or 4 minutes. So can we paint that? I know it's a big ask. Can we paint that big picture there and help people understand that high intensity training is a variable that they can manipulate to meet people where they are?
Absolutely. And, fun fact, not trying to virtue signal or name drop, but my last trip pre-pandemic was to Tokyo, Japan, to be part of a panel discussion and presentation on interval training. And the legendary Izumi Tabata was part of it. And it was really just such a thrill to be able to engage with Professor Tabata and talk about much of what you just summarized there. And you know, we would agree that and it goes back to a comment we made at the start of the interview. And that's that for many people, they define interval training as only HIIT, and in particular, all-out extreme models of HIIT, such as Tabata-style training, you know, which can be very effective, but is arguably not suited for a lot of people. You know, when we started this research, our motto was the Wingate test, which is, you know, the longest 30 seconds of your life if you've ever done a single Wingate test. So absolutely, we need to get across a couple of messages. Number one, let's start talking interval training, intermittent exercise, and not high intensity intervals or HIIT. Good. And it conveys this idea that there's a very broad spectrum of intensity. Number two, how we define intensity is important, and it depends in context. So if you are working with athletes, they often want to know, what heart rate am I at? What zone am I at? What lactate threshold zone? What's my critical power? You know, where are these anchor points so I can know what zone I'm actually in? But that doesn't resonate a lot for the average person, nor do they necessarily need that. And so getting back to simple ratings of perceived exertion or perceived effort is really, really important. And so, you know, in a lot of our studies, and I, you know, again, I talk about this in my book, what I tried to do in my book for giving sample workouts was translate the science in terms of a study. They were at this heart rate or this, you know, VO2 max percentage, but this is what it would mean on a 0 to 10 scale, where 0 is you're laying in bed, 10 sprinting to save your child from an oncoming car. And so vigorous, you know, if if you're the World Health Organization and you define vigorous, that's about 7 or 8 on a 10-point scale.
Okay.
Or on, you know, the Borg scale of 6 to 20, vigorous is 14 or 15, right? Where moderate is a little lower. So I find those notions of 0 to 10 scale to be very helpful to help people gauge just subjectively. And you can see that a little bit, right? Okay, you know, a 3, 4, 5, that's in the moderate zone. Hard, you know, is maybe around that 5.
Right.
And again, even there's no universal definition. But if we look at World Health Organization guidelines, it's going to be 7, 8 on a 10-point scale is a vigorous effort. So those are, I think, good way. And you can tell a client, hey, I just want you, you're just starting out. When you go for your walk, I want you to walk modestly at a 3 out of 10 pace. And then for those 2 light posts, 4 times, bring it up to a 5. Mm. Or just get out of your comfort zone. We'll use that wording a lot. You know, just get out of your comfort zone if you're starting out. And people have a pretty good sense of where they are and when they're out of that comfort zone for a period. And then you start to build from there.
So when you look at the relationship between intensity and duration of the work intervals with interval training, they're inversely proportional, right? The harder you push, the less time you can spend doing that. So is it settled science that a true Tabata protocol of 20 seconds all out, 10 seconds rest, which is a 2-to-1 work rest ratio, is that always more beneficial than having maybe like a 2-minute work cycle with a 2 or even a 4-minute rest cycle? And obviously you can mix and match these variables. And on top of that, Marty, sorry to jump in again, but is it beneficial to vary the profile of your work rest intervals so that you're not just working the same intervals with the same rest periods all the time? And again, where most of us, we're not athletes, we just want to be healthy. We want to be fit from a cardiorespiratory standpoint and all the things that entails. I could keep adding more questions, but we'll get lost.
No, all good. And so I guess a couple of points. It's not settled in terms of what's the best protocol for a couple of reasons. One is these studies would be infinitely complex and very challenging to achieve. And, you know, sure. I think people appreciate that in context, but in the exercise science community writ large, there, and I don't want to nerd out or have people's eyes or ears gloss over at this point, but there's a lot more thought, including, you know, we're trying to get better in terms of research designs and thinking about what's a meaningful change, what's an effect size, what's the appropriate statistical right. power and test to say that this is better or this is non-inferior, this is not significantly different right. compared to this. And you know, there are lessons being learned from the epidemiology and medical field in terms of these, you know, proper statistical designs. And so, that's point number one. And so one of the reasons why it's hard to do those studies is to tease out what might be very, very subtle differences between protocols. The scope and size in terms of the number of participants you need and all that, it you're not going to get it.
Right.
Point two is, for the vast majority of people, it probably doesn't matter. And so I'm often, sometimes people try and goad or get into these arguments, what's best, or set up, especially on Twitter, which I try to avoid now, it's my only social media, but these Twitter polemics and rants that try to set up straw man arguments around, well, HIIT is this, and then rail against it. I think we need to try and get away from arguments over what's best and just sort of appreciate that lots of things work and it really comes down to context. You know, who are we talking about and what specific outcome? You use the investing analogy for your kids, or at least a money analogy. I really like the investing analogy when it comes to, general activity. And that's, you know, you could hit a home run on a specific stock, but probably for most people, they're better, you know, spreading it out. Because that's going to pay the best returns over the long run. And I think it's the same when it comes to fitness generally, but in particular with exercise intervals, right? vary them up. And probably for most people, that's going to provide the greatest return, you know, unless, again, you're that specific athlete working to improve in a specific event and your coach has a very good understanding of you. Otherwise, I could take 1,000 of your listeners right now, put them on a specific interval protocol. Some will thrive, some will wither, right? And yeah, we probably wouldn't do a very good job of predicting who's going to do best. So, hopefully.
Well, I was going to say, to translate that down to like practical clinical stuff, if we're dealing mostly with people who have low VO2 max, they're metabolically compromised, their exercise tolerance and recovery is compromised, obviously we don't want to throw them into a full Tabata style. So can we talk about like, you know, the work rest ratio, and maybe talk about what, and I know it's unfair to ask, like, what's the optimal work rest ratio as well as intensity level? Like I imagine that it would be much better to have, for someone, again, metabolically compromised, to have maybe a 1-to-2 work rest ratio because you give them more recovery. And that's not minutes, that's just the ratio, but to have them do longer work periods because it demands less intensity and it's going to be less taxing on their physiology. So, and again, I'm just spitballing, just thinking out loud here. I might have somebody increase the intensity of any given activity, and in their, maybe in their work cycle, they go for a minute and then they rest for two. And it doesn't mean they stop, although I think you could, but they just do what they're doing with less intensity to the point where they feel themselves recovering. And so when you go for that 1 minute work output, you're not doing the same intensity as, say, a true Tabata protocol. I mean, you could probably even extend it to 2, maybe even 3 minutes with an appropriate rest interval for recovery. And that way you're now introducing the metabolic demands of interval training, which would drive the specific adaptations that we're looking for, but doing it in a way that's relatively metabolically safe, with the expectation that as their VO2 max and their metabolic capacity improves, they start to increase the intensity of their work. So the work interval shortens. And then we start going from a 1-to-2 work rest interval to a 1-to-1 to a 2-to-1 over a period of time. So I love this paradigm because, like you said, there's an infinite number of ways that you can mix and match things. Yeah. So go ahead.
So, for sure. And so, you know, let's get a marker in the ground. And, yeah, you know, where did the name of the book, The 1 Minute Workout, come from? Well, it came from a protocol that we set up, responding in part to criticism around, well, this isn't really time efficient when you do wind gates. And so our protocol that we were studying was a 2 minute warm up and a 3 minute cool down. So that's 5 minutes bookended around. And then a 5 minute work period, which was 20 seconds of hard effort, 2 minutes of recovery, 20 seconds of hard effort, 2 minutes of recovery, and the third 20 second effort. So that was the 1 minute period within 5 minutes. And then when you add on the warm up and cool down, it was 10 minutes start to finish. And within that entire period, right, it was a minute of hard work. And so really, that was a 1-to-6 ratio, if you think, during the intervening period, 20 seconds of work, 2 minutes of recovery. And we had individuals work at a self-selected, vigorous or challenging pace. And so on average, that elicits around 80% of their maximal heart rate. And so my takeaway from that, and we've done that with stair climbing, with cycling, with bodyweight style interval training, if people do that 3 times a week for 6 weeks, and, you know, again, they're getting their heart rate up to about 80% on average over this 10-minute period, we can measurably see a 1 minute improvement in 6 weeks. And so provides some context. Yes.
Wow.
You know, and again, that 1 minute improvement, you go back to the reduction in all-cause mortality risk. So, you know, and I know people are just listening to this and processing, but, you know, they could get the details from studies on my website or maybe in the show notes. But, you know, that gives you some context. And so now then we've asked the question, well, what if people just do the 20 second hard efforts a few times the day? So there your work to rest ratio is very large,
wow,
right?
You
might
yes.
do a 20-second hard effort,
yeah.
and then you have an hour of recovery. And even that can provide benefits to a boost in cardiorespiratory fitness, but of course the improvement is smaller. And it goes back to the point you were making, the longer the recovery, the lower the stress.
Yeah.
And so to flip that, it would be, yes, you're right. Maybe start clients with 20 seconds on, 2 minutes off, and then build to 20 seconds on, a minute off, 20 second, 20 second. And all you're doing there is playing work to rest ratios. There's nothing magic about 20 seconds, except that when people are very deconditioned, that's about what they can do before
right.
they would like to take that break, because even in 20 seconds, the uncomfortableness creeps in. And again, they're only working at a self-selected, challenging, vigorous pace. We're not saying sprint to save your child for those 20
right.
seconds.
Right. Yeah. And I like that, because it's self-regulating, right? You shorten the work intervals and therefore you decrease the metabolic demand compared to the same energy output for a 1 or a 2 minute work cycle. And if you let them modulate their own output, you know, naturally over time, as they start to improve metabolically, they either can go longer than say 10 seconds or 20 seconds in the interval, or they push harder. And so I like that without necessarily, you know, tying it to a heart rate, which I do have questions, because you've mentioned percentages of maximal heart rate. And I know that there are, you know, at least 3 or 4, probably more, different equations to figure out what your theoretical maximum heart rate is. And I'm interested in your take on which one is most appropriate, and even maybe talking a little bit about, well, it's probably a whole other conversation about the relative value of interval training versus, say, zone 2 cardio, which is, you know, that's another big thing these days. And, you know, I know Phil Maffetone has his MAF 180, like 180 minus your age, and that should be your training with some modifications. If you have, you know, certain criteria, it might subtract 10 beats per minute or 5 beats per minute or something like that. I know there's a question in there somewhere, but like I said, my mind is in so many different places. So take whatever you want out of what I just said and feed back to me.
Yeah, for sure. And so again, you know, in our studies, we can do these relatively well-controlled studies in the laboratory. And again, then you get criticized for, well, what's the translational value of this? Or we can do what we call more field studies, or take the research out of the laboratory, you know, like the stair climbing work, for example. Yeah. And then people have questions around, well, there was such variability in people's heart rate. You sort of can't have it both ways
yeah.
in a single study necessarily. And so, you know, again, hopefully each of those are bricks, and then you sort of take a step back and you sort of see what the house looks like as you put the bricks together. Sometimes people will self-select intensities that are lower than we would otherwise want to give them. And
yes.
so,
yes.
You know, even though in our studies where we've set and we're prescribing and monitoring every training session, and we're like, you got to get to 80% on average as a minimum. And then sometimes we're like, we want to get to a vigorous pace, and it's 75%. And that can make a difference. So there is, you know, the ACSM would define vigorous as 77% of maximal heart rate. And I think if you're getting above that, and that's where that 80% number for HIIT is reasonable, if you're below that, then you're not getting the same benefit. So it doesn't mean there's anything magic about 77 or 80, but it's a pretty good Goldilocks range. Mm. If you want the benefits of time efficient exercise, you pretty much got to get heart rate above 80% of individual max for about 10 minutes, however you do that. You know,
yeah.
that could be a constant walk. That could be some intermittent exercise. It could be 1-to-1. It could be 20 seconds on, 30 seconds off, whatever. But for me, that's sort of, again, a Goldilocks range, that if people do that a few times a week for 6 weeks, we get a measurable improvement in their fitness. So that'd be number one. What's maximal heart rate? Indeed. You know, the best way to measure maximal heart rate is through a graded exercise test to exhaustion, and we measure it in an individual. And of course, in our studies, that's what we do. So we're not guessing what someone's maximal heart rate is.
Right.
We've measured it directly. Standard deviation for any of those nomograms, whether it's 220 minus your age or 207, you know, that there's a number of them, as you know, invariably the standard deviation is 10 beats per minute. And so that means if it's 220 minus your age, that's going to be reasonable and within plus or minus 10 beats either way for two thirds of a sample size. It's going to be within 20 beats per minute for 95%. And there's going to be 5% of the population that's more than 20 beats above or below that. So it's a massive range.
Wow.
And so again, it's great for averages, but you know, for example, if we assume, you know, they're 40 years old, we use 220 minus their age, we get 180, that may actually markedly be overestimating their true maximal heart rate, which means we're going to overtrain them because anything we give them is going to be near their maximal capacity, or dramatically undertrain them in terms of relative intensity because they're able to do a lot more. Right. So, you know, ideally you'd like to have an index of your own true maximal heart rate.
Right.
Again, that might not, you know, you're not going to take a deconditioned type 2 diabetic who's overweight and have them do a maximal exercise test so you can get the number.
Exactly.
So you're restricted.
Exactly.
But if you otherwise have an individual who's open to it, you know, classic way would be once around the 400 meter track at the local high school, and that's pretty much going to get you to your maximal heart rate. So
400 splits or murder.
Directly on it, so you can individualize. Yep. Otherwise, the best we can do is estimate it. And I, you know, people can quibble over which of those calculators or equations is the best one.
Right. So in the populations that we serve, we have many clients that, you know, if you push them too hard, it's not just that they feel a little worse after the workout. They might be down for days, if not weeks. And it can flare up all kinds of other metabolic issues. And so trying to err on the side of caution, if we tried to construct a guideline for the metabolically compromised, and again, I'm just thinking off the top of my head based on what you said, 220 minus the age multiplied by some percentage of that number minus 10 beats per minute and start there and then work your way up. Like if it's a plus 10 minus 10 situation where if the formula says my max heart rate is 180, I could go, you know, 170, 190, but let's start at 170 just to hedge our bets. And if that's a reasonably appropriate way to think of things, then for the metabolically compromised, what's the lowest percentage of that max heart rate, you know, not accounting for adjustments? What's the lowest that someone can do interval training and still expect these metabolic adaptations to happen? Like, obviously, if you're doing 20% of your heart rate, your max heart rate, not much is going to happen. So do we have to get to the 80% or can we get it at 65%?
Yeah. So it depends. But even, you know, I would tweak your formula, and so there's something known as the concept of heart rate reserve or the Karvonen formula. And it is, heart rate reserve refers to the difference between your resting heart rate and your maximal heart rate. And so it takes into this idea, initial fitness, age, because, you know, the more unfit we are, the older we get, that resting heart rate tends to creep up a little bit.
Yep.
And maximal heart rate comes down. And so it gives you an idea of the extra heartbeats available that you can work with or that range that you can work under. And so there are good data on, for example, 70% of heart rate reserve correlating well with 70% of VO2 max, because there, how you would look at training intensity would be resting heart rate plus 70% of heart rate reserve gives you your target heart rate during exercise. And again, that's known as heart rate reserve.
Say that one more time for me, please.
Sure. So resting heart rate plus the desired intensity of heart rate reserve. So resting heart rate plus, for example, 70% of heart rate reserve will get you to the target heart rate during exercise that will elicit 70% for you in terms of VO2 max.
Right. So, and I love that. I love, because I understand the difference, you know, looking at someone's theoretical maximum heart rate versus their resting. The more deconditioned someone is, like you said, resting heart rate goes up, theoretical maximum comes down. So going back to my question, you said 70% there. Is that a relatively safe intensity for most people to work at?
Yeah. So again, I'd even drop it, right? And this gets to, if you're very deconditioned, you could do, 60, 65%, like get into the moderate range, right? And so this is where I think we can borrow well-established guidelines and, moving away from that term high intensity. I like terms like moderate and vigorous because they're relatively well established in the scientific literature. They're established in the fitness literature and, there's very good guidelines. And so if we, ACSM would define moderate intensity in terms of heart rate for various ages or vigorous intensity. And so, let's talk about moderate intensity intermittent exercise or moderate intensity interval training. Or vigorous intensity interval training, or near maximal, because I think it's a better. We'll start speaking the same language more that can be appropriate across disciplines: exercise science, general health and fitness, public health guidelines, and it will help clinicians and patients as well because it'll give them some markers that they can work with. And so on that, there are randomized controlled. There's epidemiological studies showing that if you stand more than you sit, you'll die less. So the bar can be pretty low in terms of what it takes to move the needle. Yeah. But I think realistically, you need to get to about that moderate zone, which is, about 60% of heart rate, 65% of maximal heart rate to, have a significant impact there. And then, obviously my bias and a flavor through all of our research is the more intense you're willing and able to work, the more the reduction in time required. And it's not a straight line. I think it's an exponential line. And it gets back to why is Tabata training so effective? It's so intense. Yeah. The original Tabatas were 170% of VO2 max pace on bike for 20 seconds. That's getting close to that sprint from danger pace. So huge intensity, but huge benefit despite small time because it's so intense.
Yes.
And so, we should think about maybe this moving up and down this exponential or curvilinear line. And so if we come down to the moderate zone, it takes a fairly significant time investment for benefit, and maybe that Goldilocks or sweet spot is somewhere in the middle of that curvilinear line, or even pushing up to the higher point on the line where you're talking the sweet spot is maybe not all out, but, vigorous, good, hard push, you're huffing and puffing, but the benefit there is very small time investment and really good return.
Yeah,
that's sort of where.
Please finish. Please finish.
I was just going to say that's what we're now starting to target in terms of our exercise snacks research, right?
Yeah.
Let's get people to that spot on the zone a couple times through the day and see what happens. And right now, we have an ongoing 2-state randomized clinical trial that is looking at exercise snacks in older, red. My age, but 40 to 60 year old, otherwise at risk individuals. And we just got approval or funding from Diabetes Canada to do the exact same thing in individuals with type 2 diabetes. And, these are well controlled scientific studies, again, randomized controlled designs that are going to be looking at cardiorespiratory fitness, blood markers of inflammation, continuous glucose monitoring to look at changes in glycemic control, working with people like John Little at the University of British Columbia, Michael Riddell at York University, established experts in exercise inflammation, exercise and diabetes. So we hope that that research team is really going to be able to advance the ball here around some of these really translational questions that impact health.
Well, when that paper comes out, I'd love to meet again and go through that because it's that kind of research that has direct applicability to the kind of work that we do with the people that we work with. And so I'm glad to hear that that's coming. I had two questions and then you mentioned the paper and they fled out of my brain. Is it, when you have somebody who is improving in their VO2 max, is it more advantageous to focus then on driving more intensity or driving more volume of work or driving increased frequency, say within a weekly timeframe? What's the main lever to pull on?
Yeah. So, you know, you want to stir up a hornet's nest, get scientists talking about the intensity versus volume issue. You know, my view, and again, right now, like literally there is almost a new systematic review and meta-analysis out every other week on some aspect of that question in some specific population or context. You know, arguably the much of the best research has been conducted by an individual named Robert Ross, Bob Ross at Queen's University, who's done very well-controlled trials where they're manipulating intensity and volume of exercise, usually in a continuous manner though, right? And so, for example, how does, you know, I'll get the details wrong, but how does, and actually it's not usually time, it's, you know, how does a 300 calorie energy expenditure at a moderate continuous effort compare to 300 calories at a vigorous intensity effort, which often is about half the time? And so some of that work would say, it doesn't matter. It's all about volume. But there is other work, including from some well-controlled studies, that would say intensity will give you a benefit in terms of your respiratory fitness response. And again, it's not settled at all. It depends on a lot of things. But I don't think there's any work, or there's not much, saying that moderate effort is going to give you the greater benefit. Yeah. When we compare equal doses or volumes,
sure.
You know, if
yeah.
anything, there's some evidence that the more vigorous approach will give you a greater benefit in terms of cardiorespiratory, and otherwise, worst case, it's the same.
You know, it makes me think about kind of old school strength training recommendations. And I know that the last 5 to 10 years, research shows that things like muscular hypertrophy is tied strictly to volume, or mostly to volume. But, you know, the old paradigm where if you want to get strong, you're lifting, you know, 1 to 5 reps, heavy weights. If you want to have increased muscular endurance, hypertrophy, you're, you know, 8 to 12 plus. And the sweet spot is kind of like 6 to 8, somewhere in there, if you want a little bit of both. Because if you lift weights that are appropriately heavy in that 6 to 8 rep range, you're going to hypertrophy. You're going to develop some endurance, but you're going to develop some strength as well. And so is it your position and belief that with interval training, that moderate intensity, longer work with an appropriate rest for whatever their metabolic capacity is that what you're saying is the sweet spot? Like, you don't necessarily have to go full on 100% Tabata, but you know, everything, if everything is zone 2 cardio, you know, you're not getting the benefits of all the things that you could do.
The sweet zone for me is vigorous exercise, right?
Vigorous.
And again,
okay.
We've talked about various ways to do that. So, that would be the answer to that. And even, you know, I don't think anyone really agrees on what zone 2 training is, but that's a whole nother podcast. And, you know, my colleague, Dr. Stuart Phillips, is challenging a lot of that old work around, you know, how many reps you need to do, and probably more to volitional fatigue in that. But I, you know, to be clear, I'm a proponent of vigorous intensity effort. I think it is a relatively time efficient way to train, fully recognizing that time is a barrier that's cited by a lot of people, but it's an excuse. And so we can't simplify human behavior and say that interval training or vigorous intermittent exercise is the cure for all,
right?
And I think that people will criticize us for saying that, even though I don't think I've ever said that. You know,
right.
And to be clear on your podcast,
sure,
interval training is not the cure for everything, and time is an excuse for a lot of people and not the barrier that it's otherwise made out to be. All that to be said, a lot of people do lead very vigorous, time-pressed lives or don't have the inclination to engage in continuous moderate physical activity for a long time. And we've been telling people to do basically the same thing for 50 years, and it hasn't got us that far.
Yeah.
And so if we can establish, you know, I think there's value in looking at alternatives, options that may be appealing to some individuals, and they might engage in it, and it might benefit their health and fitness. But the Goldilocks range for me is minimal time investment, vigorous pace, which means you got to huff and puff a bit. You're not for going for a stroll. You're not saving your child sprinting as hard as you can. And that's something that people can incorporate in their everyday lives, whether it's standing up from my chair right now and doing a set of air squats,
sure,
or walking over the stairs and doing a few quick ascents up and down after this interview ends.
Minimal effective frequency.
The Hunt study from Norway, which was published almost 20 years ago, was the conclusion was a single weekly bout of vigorous intensity exercise is sufficient to reduce all-cause mortality risk.
Wow.
So, you know, when we, again, you're from Canada, we see the classic, you know, and very sad headlines once in a while of the, you know, older middle-aged individual who plays weekly bout of ice hockey in a beer league with his friends and suddenly drops dead from an apparent MI. And of course, those are tragic individual instances. But big picture, if, you know, many people did that weekly bout of vigorous intensity exercise, it's going to do more benefit than harm when we look at the big picture. And that was echoed in my book when I interviewed people like Dr. Paul Thompson, who is an MD cardiologist, leading cardiologist, who said, you know, if you had to pick interval, high intensity intervals or doing nothing, do HIIT. If you're older, at risk, you know, are you picking vigorous, intense exercise or continuous moderate? Maybe do the moderate, at least when you're first starting out and until you establish a base. But if you had to do one or the other, intervals are better than nothing. The greatest risk to your health is remaining absolutely sedentary. And even a single weekly bout of it is going to be beneficial as compared to nothing, even though it's going to acutely increase risk of an event in some individuals while they're engaged in the activity.
Right. You know, I find myself often saying to people that any exercise is better than none, but some exercise modalities and way of exercising are far superior to others. You know, just to caution anybody listening here, this entire conversation is, you know, kind of its own silo because we haven't even talked about the effective combining of strength training, for example, and the different ways of strength training, or even the relative merits of combining periodic interval training with some steady state cardio, call it zone two or whatsoever. But it seems to me that you're saying, Marty, that if you had a choice, if you're crunched on time and you had to make a choice between steady state cardio, it's going to take you an hour versus 10, 15 minutes of moderate intensity intervals, you would go for the intervals. And that's not just your personal opinion, or if it is, your opinion is informed by your research. Is that correct?
Yes, that is. And, you know, if you're the person who prefers moderate intensity cardio, awesome, go for it. You know, don't ever do intervals. But yes, you're absolutely right, because I think there's good translational value in that. And also it goes back to the idea of infinite variety. You know, there's only so many ways to jump on a treadmill and jog at a moderate pace for 45 minutes or an hour. But in 15 minutes of intervals, the sky's the limit in terms of how to vary it up. It doesn't make it better. It doesn't make it best. It doesn't mean everyone should do it. And it's not demonizing traditional cardio or the physical activity guidelines.
Right.
But yeah, you know, I choose to that, you know, intervals, I rarely work out for more than 30 minutes. Right. And except this afternoon, because I will go to my weekly pickup ice hockey game, which is a highlight of the week. And then the fourth period, of course, is a bar where I have a beer with my friends. But, you know, it works for me. It doesn't mean that's what everyone should do. But yeah, to your point, my opinion is informed by a lot of good science out there.
Yeah. I think I'm out of questions because my brain is overloaded.
You know, happy to be back at some point.
I love it.
But I really appreciate the opportunity to speak with you, and hopefully our conversation is of some value to to your listeners and the clients that they work with.
No, this has been wonderful. And you've delivered exactly what I wanted, was a discussion of the science and a rational translation into the type of clinical scenarios that our community typically deals with. Because the metabolic demands and needs of the people that are sick are different than the average person who might be a little bit overweight, might, eating a standard American diet, but they don't have the types of problems that the community that we serve really is kind of unique in that sense. So I appreciate it. I will have you back anytime. I'll have you back tomorrow. I'm free tomorrow if you want to talk tomorrow.
Awesome. Well, Dr. Noser, like I said, appreciate the interest and this opportunity. It's been a pleasure to speak with you.
Likewise. Thanks, Marty.